Series with a 5-1 win over the Dodgers in Game 7 last night. NBA, Bucks lose to Charlotte, Bulls lose to Miami, both teams off tonight. NHL, Blackhawks shut out the Flyers 3-0. NFL, Thursday Night Football, Buffalo and the Jets. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, November 2nd. Cloudy and seasonal, areas of morning fog, also a 40% chance of more rain, high of 53. No rain in the immediate vicinity. Wind from the south-southwest at 3. It is 45 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Happy to be sitting across the table this morning from Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. And Professor Mast, of course, joins us from time to time to help us delve into the wonderful, wild, wacky, and often disturbing world of politics, and particularly in the current landscape in which we find ourselves right now, with it seeming as though a lot of old political ways of doing things are pretty much thrown out the window, and it just feels like we are in a very, very different environment. Certainly some things stay the same, but a whole lot of things at least feel different and look very, very different from what they once were. And are some of those changes for the better? Are some of those changes for the worse? We'll be talking about the presidency of Donald Trump, roughly 10 months in office. We'll be talking about how things are functioning and failing to function in Washington, D.C. We'll look at the current affairs of both the Democratic Party and Republican Party, and certain recent headlines and events, including the latest in the Robert Mueller investigation. Professor Mast, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Gregory. It's always good to be here.
I'm very, very happy to welcome you. Let's start at the top. Let's start with the man in the Oval Office, President Donald Trump. Again, we'll be coming up on the 10-month mark for the Trump presidency. I think one way to frame this question is maybe to ask you, as you look back on these first 10 months, are you surprised, or has this Trump presidency been what you at least roughly expected it would be?
Well, let me begin with the caveat that I did not expect the Trump presidency. In many ways, the answer to your question is a complicated one of being surprised on a kind of a regular basis. But once I began to think about what to expect, given the fact of President Trump's election, this is kind of moving more or less according to what I started to expect over time. And I guess my sense of what it is that I'm seeing and what it is that I've come to expect is a lot of struggle. I think that the Trump administration has not performed up to expectation for a normal presidency, and we can look at a couple of things, just as kind of basic, crude metrics for that. One is the amount of legislative accomplishment to this point, almost nothing. The president has managed to successfully appoint a member to the Supreme Court. That is a move that has made his supporters and Republicans more generally very happy. But beyond that, there really hasn't been much, despite many kind of promises on the campaign trail of fixing the country's problems. So the lack of legislative accomplishment would be one thing. If you look at the polling numbers of support, he's pretty much mired in the mid-30s, fluctuating between the upper 30s and sometimes even the low 30s. And that is kind of a historical, historically poor performance. And so, throw in some kind of anecdotal criticism from abroad, allies expressing concern and dismay over some of the decisions. And I think you can say that the administration has not functioned the way one would expect a normal administration to function.
One thing that maybe should not have been a surprise is that somebody who was brandishing himself proudly as an outsider, is that an outsider would have struggles in much the same way that, for instance, somebody like Jimmy Carter did, or Bill Clinton did, coming in not as people well acquainted with Washington and its ways. And of course, somebody sympathetic to President Trump would say that the difficulties he's had in accomplishing things has as much to do with Washington, with the swamp, as he would put it, as it does with anything that he's doing in terms of poor decisions.
And I would agree with that. I think that the problems associated with what's happening in Washington right now there's many factors involved. Some of them are structural. Some of them are an outcome of developments in the political environment that have been unfolding now for multiple years. And part of it, I think, is President Trump's responsibility. So it's not just one thing. It's many things that explain why the administration hasn't been able to accomplish more than it has. I like your choice of kind of analogs of outsiders. President Carter and President Clinton, neither of them had any Washington experience. I think that where the analogy is perhaps not as strong is in the fact that both men had plenty of governing experience. Both men were governors and had experience working with a system, of separated powers and checks and balances, and had responsibility for overseeing the legislating of the things that states require. Both men did, in fact, struggle because of the lack of Washington experience, and their relationships with the Congress were often rocky. I think one kind of key difference between President Carter on the one hand and President Clinton on the other is that President Clinton adjusted fairly well a couple years into his first term, brought in some old Washington insiders, including a fellow across the aisle, Brent Gergen, a congressman from Minnesota and a longtime kind of political authority in Washington, stepped in to do some advising, and he was able to kind of course correct. For President Trump, he has not shown any inclination to trying to make that adjustment. In fact, he's kind of doubled down on some of his behaviors that have almost, I think you have to say, intentionally antagonized members of the Congress. So he seems fairly stubbornly committed to this idea that Washington needs to fall into line behind his own particular agenda. And I think one thing that is interesting as a political scientist is the degree to which separated powers is still a thing.
Right, and a reality that people just have to embrace and decide to make work somehow. Another question about Donald Trump that came to mind recently. This was when I was having a Facebook conversation with probably the most conservative of any of my Facebook friends. And this gentleman was essentially suggesting that President Trump is actually far more popular than certain poll numbers would suggest. And essentially, what he was basing that on was the vast number of Americans who did not vote in this most recent presidential election. And I'm not suggesting, I don't think he's suggesting that it was an extraordinarily high number of people who chose not to vote in this election. I'd be curious to know if you recall the numbers in terms of what it was, it a strong turnout or not.
It wasn't.
No. But the question is, and it kind of goes back to the fact that so many people were completely surprised that President Trump was elected in the first place. But in fact, is there a possibility that there is actually a much wider swath of Americans that in fact feel very good about President Trump, but for various reasons are kind of beneath the radar of polls and so on, and are not, and their feelings are not being accounted for?
I'm very skeptical of that. I don't think that that's true. I do think that you could say that a 35% approval rating for President Trump misses something or doesn't communicate something, and that is the intensity with which that 35% support him. And so perhaps it is the case that while President Trump's base of support within the population is relatively narrow, it is within that range rather strong. And I think to a certain extent, people can be forgiven for thinking that the circles in which they move socially represents a bigger percentage of the population, because there's not a lot of interaction across partisan lines these days, or that the number of interactions across partisan lines has declined. And so I'll commend you for having, conservative Facebook friends and for having conversations with them, as well as liberal Facebook friends. But the fact is that's not so much the case for many Americans. And so one of the environmental factors that I think is making governing more difficult, regardless of who's in office, is the fact that ordinary Americans don't have a real clear sense of the diversity of opinion out there, and so when you wind up with certain kinds of representatives, for instance, Ms. Murkowski or Ms. Collins, senators from Alaska and Maine, respectively, refusing to fall into line with a party vote, people are amazed or surprised. And on the one hand, those are kind of courageous positions to take, and they do represent a kind of a deviation from the intense amplification of party line voting that we've seen. On the other hand, it's not hard to understand why they're taking those positions, because they have constituencies, right, that they're going to know more about in terms of their interests and their perspectives, there's a rational reason for not falling in line with one's party. There's a lot of variation, not just across the parties, but there's variation within them.
We're speaking with Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College, talking politics on today's morning show. Right now, talking about the presidency of Donald Trump, roughly 10 months in office. One of the concerns or criticisms that has been raised is the matter of appointments and of many appointment slots essentially being left vacant longer than is usual. Is that a legitimate concern, and has there been any movement on that, and what's going on there?
Yeah, I think it is a very legitimate concern. The political scientists have been increasingly making this argument for a number of years now that despite conventional wisdom, a very good case exists that the federal government is understaffed, that we would in fact be much more effective at executing or implementing the policies that the government that are already on the books if there were more people to actually carry out the work. The reporting on the issue of appointments has kind of focused on the State Department. The number of positions in the State Department that have not been filled are very large. I think that is in some sense a function of the White House, one, struggling to recruit qualified persons to fill those positions. And I think that is in some sense a function of the kind of the hostility that the Trump administration has taken towards a kind of a traditional American foreign policy perspective. And so the journalist Peter Beinart wrote a recent column about this, talking about kind of different visions in American political tradition. On the one hand, you have a kind of a Hamiltonian vision wherein the United States is seen as this exporter of an economic vision of capitalism and economic freedom and trying to promote this around the world. And traditional Republicans have kind of aligned themselves with that perspective. You have a kind of a Wilsonian perspective, right? This idea of exporting democracy and principles of equality and freedom around the world. And Democrats have kind of embraced that perspective. But you also have this tradition of Jacksonian viewpoint of kind of a just leave us alone, and we'll leave you alone. We take care of ourselves. You take care of yourself. And if you mess with us, we'll come at you pretty hard and fast. And I think the Trump administration has really kind of embraced this Jacksonian perspective, which is at odds with the foreign policy experts who are out there, who see kind of in a natural and logical way the United States is usefully engaged in foreign relations, in engaged in the world and trying to negotiate solutions to kind of collective interests and so forth. And the administration's foreign policy philosophy is kind of at odds with that. And so it's had a hard time recruiting people to come in and fill these positions. And the people who are already there, the kind of the careerists, according to the reporting, are very demoralized and dejected because the administration is moving in a direction that is quite different from either Republican or Democratic administrations that have preceded it.
Fascinating. That segues nicely into a question about how Washington right now is functioning and to whatever extent it is performing or not performing the way it typically has. How much do we lay that at the doorstep of President Trump, or is it due to other factors that Washington seems to be a very different place than it once was?
Well, I'll start with the latter. Why is Washington struggling to function particularly well? And I think that one important factor there, a very important factor there, is essentially polarization in the American public. I think it's fair to describe the American electorate as for the most part non-ideological. That is to say, most Americans don't have a very clear sense of the philosophy of conservatism or the philosophy of liberalism. And if you ask them to, what does it mean to be a conservative? Your average American would say, well, you vote Republican, you believe in small government, taxes should be low, businesses should be less regulated than more so. And that would be kind of be it. If you ask them to explain the philosophy of liberalism, they could say things like, you know, a greater acceptance of larger government, kind of worried about the poor, maybe, you know, protective of, you know, the environment, accepting high taxes. And that might be the extent of what your average person could tell you about conservatism or liberalism. So there's not a particularly sophisticated sense of these philosophies amongst the public. That said, there are segments of the population that is have more coherent ideological viewpoints, right? And as we move from the likelihood that you're engaged in politics to less so, right, or the other way around, if we go from somebody who's not particularly involved in politics, doesn't care that much about politics, towards those who are more engaged, their ideological perspectives become more coherent, and they're moving farther apart. And so, and this is particularly true amongst politicians, the party elite, and so forth. And because we have the system of checks and balances and separated powers, right? It's really one. It's big for the. It needs to be acknowledged that it's difficult to govern. Period. Right. This is a system of government, a structure of government designed purposely to make it difficult to govern. Because it's difficult to govern, you need to kind of create consensus kinds of positions. That means moving to the center, compromising, things like that. And as the two parties become farther apart in terms of what it is that they'd like to see accomplished, that's naturally going to be more and more difficult to govern. I would argue that increasing influence of interest groups kind of exacerbates that. That's another kind of environmental factor. When it comes to President Trump himself as a kind of a causal explanation for why government has become more gridlocked, I would, you know, look to the rather, I think, remarkable speech delivered on the floor of the Senate by Senator Jeffrey Flake from Arizona a couple weeks, in which he identified a number of things. He didn't call out President Trump by name, but it was clearly directed at the White House, in which he was very critical of the president on a number of levels. One, criticizing him on policy for deviating from a couple of important kind of planks in the traditional conservative perspective. One would be trade, first and foremost. Two would be foreign policy kind of commitment to institutions like NATO. And then I think you could also say immigration as well, although immigration's a little bit more complicated than say, trade is. Senator Flake clearly calling out the president on policy areas. But beyond policy kind of differences, much of the tenor and character of his criticism of the White House was about character and civility and kind of political manners and the lack of them that the president has exhibited in his time in office. So the quickness and frequency with which the president criticizes other people, criticizes people who don't agree with him, criticizes foreign countries and foreign leaders, all, to use Senator Flake's term, contribute to a coarseness of the political culture, a coarseness of public dialogue, and our need to get along with one another, because we have differences, we're different, we have different perspectives, different interests, and so forth. Our need to get along with one another doesn't change, but our ability to get along with each other goes down, and so our kind of collective commitment to democracy, our collective commitment to important public institutions like a free press, like the Congress, like an independent judiciary, and so forth, all kind of is weakened or frayed by a kind of intense group partisan loyalty and loyalty to particular persons rather than to ideals and principles that is at the core of the kind of the American project. And so I think that where we can kind of identify President Trump's contribution to things not working out in Washington, D.C., is that he has made the political climate more angry. He's made the political climate more polarized around him. You know, to be called out for all of that by a member of your own party is highly, highly unusual. I mean, I can't think of an example like this. And Senator Flake, well, I mean, I can think of other examples, right? But the recent ones, so Senator Corker, Bob Corker from Tennessee, a Republican, also has come out in the media in the past several weeks, critical of the president for this kind of coarseness. And Senator Sass has done so. Senator Sass is a Republican from Nebraska. And Senator McCain, a Republican from Arizona, of course, has also been openly critical. And so a president needs positive relationships with the Congress, right? And for the most part, that means you rely on a positive relationship with your party, and then you work with enough members of the opposition party to try to facilitate a successful, you know, governing agenda. And President Trump has dismissed the need to kind of cultivate this positive kind of consensus and climate of amity that is necessary for governing.
It almost seems as if he expects that in the wake of his election to the presidency, that something similar is going to happen on Capitol Hill, and essentially all of these bums will be run out of office as well, and it'll be a new day with a U.S. Congress that very closely aligns to his vision for America.
Right. He's not unique in the sense that all politicians overinterpret the meaning of their election. They tend to see their election as some kind of mandate from the people for the vision that they laid out. And that is almost never the case, because the electorate is diverse and eclectic, and the reasons for voting for any given individual are going to be also very, 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 very diverse. And so, the what looks like a plurality or a majority in the electorate in terms of casting votes. And I'll point out that President Trump did not win a majority of the votes. He won a minority of the votes. But even then, right, within the total number of votes that he received, multiple motivations went into that, right? And then, of course, there is the fact that, you know, we elect a president who is, only in a very limited sense in charge of government, right? Within his own branch, his powers are limited. Presidents they always depend upon the agreement of the agencies and departments and offices to go along with what it is that they want. So one way in which they get that kind of compliance is by appointing people at the top of the agencies and the offices. Those political appointments, right, reflect some kind of agreement on a political vision. But the thousands of people who work in those agencies, right, they're careerists, they're professional civil servants. And the degree to which they fall into line and comply with these kinds of things is in some sense a function of the president's powers to persuade the members of his branch that his vision is compelling and appropriate and effective and deserves to be agreed to. That's just within his own branch. I mean, the Congress is an entirely separate branch. And so, again, I think that because over time Americans have watched the presidency grow in terms of responsibility, there is this expectation that presidents are therefore kind of formally or officially powerful persons. And I suspect that that is probably what Mr. Trump himself thought. But the fact of the matter is, although presidents' responsibilities have grown so much, their formal powers have not. The formal powers still remain what they are in Article 2 of the Constitution. And the ability of presidents to effectively carry out those expanded responsibilities is really a function of their political power, right? Their capacity to build broad-based coalitions, to reach out and make allies and keep allies, and to expand that group of people willing to buy into the vision that the person is selling. Hmm. And the formal powers are woefully inadequate for that. You need to put on top of the official powers, right, this kind of political, charismatic, political capital that presidents bring to the table. And, you know, from where I sit, President Trump has kind of assumed, right, that compliance, that agreement is a kind of an entitlement that he has by virtue of having won the election, and it most certainly isn't.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. How would you assess at the moment the state of affairs, the health, if you will, of both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party? We certainly see on the Republican side some tumult, some division, and it's probably an oversimplification to not notice comparable divisions within the Democratic Party, perhaps not as severe, but there are a lot of interesting things right. that both parties faced at the moment. Let's start with the right. Republicans.
Yeah, I think you characterized it correctly. Both parties are undergoing a period of real instability and change. I think it is, in fact, fair to say that the Republican Party, it's outright insurrection in many ways. And so you have a kind of a core conservative, traditional establishment perspective amongst the elite of the party, and there's some variation in that for sure. Especially if you look at the last 7 years, the growth of the kind of the Tea Party movement has created a kind of populist conservative wing in the Republican Conference and Congress. That you know has some important differences with kind of the establishment, and the Freedom Caucus in the House is a great example of that. But in many ways, I think that the election of President Trump involves a real refutation of the establishment on the part of many Republican voters, an expression of their frustration and anger that they feel, right, or explain by kind of a perceived failure on the part of the establishment to effectively bring about some solution to the concerns that they have, concerns that are rooted in a kind of a conservative cultural viewpoint, a sense that the country is changing culturally around them in directions that they're not comfortable with, and that the establishment Republicans have been unable to do anything about. A real kind of sense of frustration that, you know, I think economically, right, in many kind of conventional metrics, the economy has done very well. Unemployment is low. The financial markets are high. Inflation isn't out of control by any stretch of the imagination. And yet there's still, I think, very legitimate worries or fears about the kind of economic conditions that reflect a kind of a slowing down of income growth for ordinary working class people. And so within certain significant sections of the economy, you know, people are not experiencing the positive elements of the economy that exist overall. So an unequal distribution of the economy's benefits means that there's a group of people who are really frustrated and worried that the political economic system is not fairly affording them the opportunities. And so their embrace of President Trump, I think, is an attempt, right, to send a very clear message to the Republican establishment that something has to change. The establishment, I think, is rightly and should feel beleaguered in many ways under attack, not from the Democrats, but from their own grassroots. And so they're having to kind of sit down and rethink, you know, well, what do we think about trade? What do we think about you know, fiscal policy? What do
tax reform.
Tax reform. Now, I think really interestingly, they're not taking a very particularly populist message with the tax reform approach that, I mean, we are hearing about, where the taxes, the tax cuts that are reported to be in the bill that they're putting forward are heavily weighted to high-income Americans. And that's not popular outside of a very small percentage of Americans. Even a majority of Republicans are not supportive of cutting taxes on the very wealthy. And so, you know, I'm not convinced that the establishment Republicans in Congress have learned all the kind of the lessons of the populist insurrection that President Trump represents. But certainly, I think that they should be paying attention.
As should the Democrats as well. What in what ways is this current situation fraught with tricky choices for them?
I think in many ways the kind of narrative that I've laid out as it applies to the Republican Party also applies to the Democratic Party. So, I mean, if we turn back the clock, 1980, President Reagan is elected, and there is this, you know, kind of conservative shift on some level. I mean, we can overstate how far to the right the country shifted in that respect. But I do think that President Reagan's administration reflected a kind of a popularity of this kind of conservative narrative. And amongst the Democrats at the time, the Democratic Leadership Council was created. Bill Clinton was a part of that. There was a term called New Democrats, right, that came out at the end of the 80s and early 90s, and Bill Clinton was the most famous example of the New Democrats. And the New Democrats were new in the sense that they were promoting a more centrist, business-friendly economic platform, kind of married to a socially liberal perspective. That became very popular within the kind of the upper echelons of the Democratic Party. The Democratic establishment, if you will, kind of bought into this idea that a kind of a centrist, pro-business viewpoint married to a more socially liberal perspective was the way to go. And those same kinds of frustrations that kind of the Republican kind of populist anger motivating that Republican populist anger in terms of a kind of a failure for social mobility to continue as it used to, the kind of the stagnation of wages for the working class that motivated the populist insurrection in the Republican side, that is also being felt in the Democratic side. And so you have this real, and especially in the wake of the recession of 2007 and the bailing out of the banks and so forth, you had Occupy Wall Street, and very, very prominent criticism of the Democratic establishment from within the Democratic Party has been percolating now for a number of years. You have the election of Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts on this platform of very economic progressive regulation of finance, and of course Senator Sanders from Vermont and his surprisingly strong challenge to Ms. Clinton for the nomination last year is another manifestation of that. And so, you know, where the Democratic Party goes right now is an open question. And I think that, you know, one interesting fact on the Democratic side is there's really not a very vocal resistance to the Trump administration coming from the Democratic side right now. I mean, there is on the grassroots, make no mistake, lots of people on the grassroots offering trenchant and very passionate criticisms of the president. But in Washington, it's pretty kind of muted.
Right. It's almost as though they're just allowing this to play out.
And that's how it looks to me.
And almost feeling like they don't have to add their voices to.
That's right. I think that's a mistake.
Interesting. We, of course, are having our conversation in the wake of a fairly dramatic announcement within the last week of the first indictments offered up in the Robert Mueller investigation. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Let's talk about this investigation and at this point what it appears to mean for the Trump administration, who are pointing out the fact that these initial indictments, they are characterizing them as not really taking aim at anybody directly associated with President Trump during his campaign, this is about something else much more peripheral. Do you think that characterization is going to be able to be carried through? And what would you think is next?
Well, I wouldn't bet on it. I think that reflects a lot of wishful thinking and optimistic spin on their part, which is understandable given the situation that they're in. I think that the developments in the Mueller investigation do in fact represent a great deal of political peril for the president. The indictments levied against his former campaign manager Paul Manafort and his assistant do in fact by a good measure predate their involvement with the Trump administration. But those indictments involve some very serious crimes, tax evasion and fraud and conspiracy, and the potential penalties for those are very significant. So Mr. Manafort and his deputy are pretty vulnerable in a legal position right now. That in itself doesn't necessarily constitute significant threat to the Trump administration, but when you pair it with the announcement that the campaign advisor, Mr. Papadopoulos, has agreed to a plea, pled guilty to a reduced charge, and has been cooperating with the Mueller investigation, suggests that what the Mueller has against Manafort it reflects a good deal of leverage to try to move him into a position of cooperation to identify other people in the Trump circle. I think all of this reflects a very aggressive approach by the prosecutor. And of course, you know, whether this amounts to actual evidence of illegal, cooperation on the part of the Trump campaign with Russian authorities or not, is in some sense not the point. I think that the president's potential legal vulnerabilities lie outside the kind of the campaign and are more financial related to his businesses. But even that is a potential target if the special prosecutor decides to make them as such. And given that the business potential business crimes that might be out there also involve Russia, then I mean that might be a connection that can be used to justify it. Again, what all of this really kind of reflects as far as the president is concerned is not just kind of legal vulnerabilities, but also political vulnerabilities. I mean, the issue of impeachment is not necessarily legality. It's a matter of kind of political mistakes or political actions that are not in keeping with the national interest, with the expectations that the country and the culture have of what is proper presidential behavior.
What about what has been bandied about the idea that this investigation could actually also unearth possible collusion that would have involved, for instance, Mrs. Clinton or even President Obama? How serious a reality is that?
Well, I mean, I think it's serious, again, in terms of the politics of it, more so than the legality of it, and the fact that the Clinton campaign retained the services of a firm in the wake of their being retained by a conservative organization to drum up incriminating evidence of President Trump. From Russian sources. I mean, And it just seems unseemly, doesn't it? I mean, it seems really unseemly. And so to the extent that, you know, the Democrats need to try to muster an effective opposition to the Republicans if they're going to take back power in Washington in the midterms next year and in the next presidential election in 2020, then, I mean, they really have got to worry about the fact that they too seem to be, you know, tainted in ways that they're leveling accusations against the president. You know, one obvious difference is that, you know, Ms. Clinton is not president of the United States, and Mr. Trump is. Mm-hmm.
What about the reports over the last couple of days in terms of what we're now learning about what the Russians have been doing in terms of some of our social media platforms? The mounting of various ads and the bringing up of various news stories on platforms like Facebook,
right,
which seem to have been designed to wreak political havoc here,
right,
here within our borders. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that the number of reasons to be worried about social media and its impact on, you know, polarizing Americans, making us vulnerable to being, you know, susceptible to believing news that isn't true, is real enough as it is. The fact that a foreign adversary has taken advantage of social media platforms to amplify what already was a big problem should worry everybody. I think undeniable that social media is a contributing factor to, you know, the rising levels of animosity and friction amongst the public, and it is a serious concern that Americans are increasingly lacking a kind of a common base or sense of what reality is. And so the percolation through the political culture of false stories, of untrue things, really, really is an obstacle to trying to create a sense of common purpose amongst the public.
What's the difference between somebody in Russia doing that and somebody here doing that? I mean, that is a true blue American citizen,
right,
posting things that aren't quite true,
right,
or designed to.
Well, I would say that ostensibly the person who's doing it here is doing so because he or she believes that, you know, whatever it is they're trying to further is in the interests of the country. I assume, naturally, that Russia is acting not in U.S. interests, but in its own. And so to the degree to which division or friction amongst the public is the outgrowth of genuinely held American beliefs, right, mm-hmm, by some American set of Americans, whether you believe them or not, right, at least it's some American perspective with a particular vision of what the American interest is. We don't have to agree with it, right? And we're not going to, by definition of the question's parameters. But, right, at least the motivations there, I think, you know, are more or less trustworthy. Whereas, you know, by definition, when a foreign actor steps in and tries to sow these divisions, they're not doing it because they have some kind of genuine belief that this is in the interest of the United States, but rather the opposite, that they're trying to undermine the interests of the United States.
Well, and particularly when there are clear instances in which the same entity in Russia has, for instance, put out their items on either side of a divisive,
right,
issue.
Right, they're definitely playing both sides against one another.
Interesting. Well, on that unsettling note, not that there's a simple solution that we would be hearing from you if we had the time, but we need to leave it there with this really important concern and many, many others that, of course, are galvanizing our attention right now at the moment. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today on the morning show to talk about kind of a plethora of really intriguing and challenging questions. I should think that you are, as a political science professor, relishing this moment, at least to some extent.
I don't know if relishing is the right word, but I do feel a sense of obligation, because although a lot of these issues are anxiety-inducing and frustrating, making our way through them is indeed important.
Absolutely. Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College, thank you for today.
No, thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we talk about one of the most beautiful and intriguing creatures in all the world, the jaguar. Support for the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, combining an environment of